We'll turn again to 1 Peter chapter 5, and we've come to verse 8. Be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. Peter, you'll remember, is writing to suffering Christians. They are being persecuted in the most cruel and heartbreaking ways. And Peter gives them a series of instructions to show them how they must handle this situation. He wants to teach them how Christians come to terms with suffering, how Christians should respond to suffering. So between verses 6 and 8, we have three vital commands. We've looked at two of them already. The first command in verse 6, humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand. The second command in verse 7, cast all your anxiety on him. And this morning we come to the third command in verse 8, be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Resist him, standing firm in the faith. Now, the first two of those commands make it clear that times of suffering can be times of great benefit for a Christian. In times of suffering, firstly, we can learn true humility. We humble ourselves under the mighty hand of God. We learn to see ourselves as we really are. We learn how small we are, and how helpless, and how sinful. And we learn to see God as he really is. We learn to see his greatness, and his sovereignty, and his wisdom, and his holiness. And we learn to care about others. We learn to put their needs before our own. In times of suffering, firstly, we can learn humility, and that is a great benefit. And then, in times of suffering, secondly, we can learn real trust. We learn to cast all our anxiety on God. We learn to believe that he cares for us. We learn to leave our worries and our fears with God. We learn to trust him to care for us and to rescue us in his own way and in his own time. We learn to wait for God. We learn patience. So suffering can lead to great benefit for the Christian. Christians in time of suffering can learn lessons that they could learn no other way. They can learn true humility, and they can learn real trust. And we've all met Christians, haven't we, of whom this is true. We've all met Christians who have been through terrible experiences of suffering. Christians who have suffered years of physical pain. Christians who have had to go through terrible persecution. We've got some youngsters messing about in the car park, Peter. We've met Christians who have suffered in all sorts of fearful ways, whatever it might be. And they've come through it. And they've come through it full of love for God and full of compassion for others. And we see in them a wonderful contentment and joy and tranquility. And they've learned these lessons in suffering. suffering can do us great good if we use it rightly. And that's what we learn from these first two commands. But now, in verse 8, Peter comes to this third command. And Peter makes it plain that suffering can also do great damage to us as Christians if we do not respond to it rightly. Peter says, be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Peter is warning us that times of suffering are times of danger. Yes, times of suffering are times of spiritual opportunity. But they are also times of spiritual danger. You can see, can't you, Peter's language is drawn from warfare. This is the sort of language which you would address to troops. You can imagine a company of soldiers who are huddled in their trench. And the company commander is warning them. And he says to them, remember, the attack could come tonight. So be ready, be alert. Yes, I know you're tired, but you can't afford to sleep tonight. Yes, I know that you're struggling, but it makes no difference. You've got to pull yourselves together. You're in danger. Be ready for the attack whenever it comes. If it comes and you're not expecting it, you're dead. Remember, he says to his troops, you're in danger. And that's what Peter is saying to these believers. They're going through a time of suffering. He says to them, you're in danger. You must be self-controlled. That's to say, you must be disciplined. You can't afford to relax. Yes, I know you're tired. I know you're aching. But you've got to be on your guard. You've got to be alert. You've got to be wide awake. You've got to realize you're in danger. That's the first great lesson we have here. That a time of suffering is a time of spiritual danger for the Christian. It's a time of opportunity if it's used rightly. But it is also a time of great danger if it's not. And if we are not expecting it, if we are not prepared for it, we may be left damaged or ruined by it. Now, where does this danger spring from? Well, it springs from the fact that we have an enemy. And our enemy wants to use our suffering to destroy us spiritually. And he is a terrible enemy. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Now let me ask you, do you believe that? I'm speaking to believers, those of you who are Christians, and I ask you, do you believe that? You have an enemy. An implacable, cruel enemy who is determined to destroy you. It is not just that he is the enemy of the church as a whole. He is your enemy. And he is determined to destroy you. He is waiting and watching every moment for an opportunity to tear you apart spiritually. Remember all that the Bible tells us about this enemy, the devil, this great spiritual being. He has huge power. He has vast intelligence. He is unspeakably ancient. And he has huge resources at his disposal. He heads up a vast empire of evil. And he is your enemy. This very day, this very hour, while you sit here in this holy gathering, he is planning ways to get behind your guard. He is seeking ways to weaken your hold upon God, to stop you from walking with God, to capture and make you his plaything, to ruin you for his pleasure. Peter says he's like a roaring lion. He's full of rage. He's filled with a burning, raging hatred. His great hatred is against God. If he could drag God down from heaven and trample on him, he would do. But he can't. So instead, he vents his hatred and his anger against God's people. And he's hungry. He's prowling around looking for someone to devour. You see, he himself is a wretched, eternally ruined creature, and he knows it. And now the only twisted satisfaction he can get is in making other creatures as wretched as he is. And so he's hungry for you. He longs to see you as wretched, as hopeless, as ruined as he is. He knows that his destiny is the pit of fire. And the only twisted compensation he can find is if he can drag you down with him into his eternal despair. He wants you for himself. And he's stalking you. With infinite cunning, he's prowling, says Peter, trying to maneuver himself into a position where he can spring. He doesn't always roar. He doesn't want you to be aware of his presence. He stalks you silently. He tries to keep himself hidden. He tries not to let you know that you're in danger. Until the moment when he springs to destroy you and to devour you. Imagine a man walking through the jungle. And it's twilight. And there are dark shadows across the path. And as he tries to find his way between the trees and through the thick foliage, he hears a rustling noise, as if some great beast is pushing its way through the undergrowth. And he stops. And the sound stops. And he sets off again. And again he thinks he hears the sound behind him. But it's a bit closer now. It's coming closer. And his heart begins to beat a little faster. And he begins to move a little faster. And he throws a glance over his shoulder. And he just catches a glimpse of a yellow shape through the leaves. And now as he hurries on, he can hear a deep growl and the heavy panting. And he knows that the beast is very close. And now he's beginning to run. He's panicking. And he can hear the pad of great paws as the beast begins to run behind him. And then he hears the roar. The terror of a man who knows he's being stalked. Can you imagine it? And you are being stalked today. By a terrible unseen enemy. And he's been stalking you since the day you became a Christian. and it may be that he's closer to some of you than you imagine. You can see, can't you, why Peter says, be alert. What chance has a man in that situation if he doesn't even realise he's in danger? If he's just strolling through the jungle cheerfully, whistling, unaware of the danger in the background. He's not listening. He's not watching. He doesn't realise the lion is even there until it's too late. The only way a man can hope to survive is if he's constantly vigilant. If he's aware all the time of danger. If he's listening for every warning signal. His gun is ready at hand. The safety catch is off. He's ready if he has to run and climb a tree just to give him a few moments. Well, a man like that who's constantly vigilant may escape the enemy. But a man who's not ready, a man who sees no danger, a man who stops taking precautions, a man who's not guarding himself, what chance has he against such an enemy? Peter surely is remembering his own fall. Do you remember Jesus warned Peter? Jesus said to Peter, Satan has desired to have you, to sift you like wheat. He warned Peter that Satan was stalking him, that Peter was in danger, and Peter couldn't take it seriously. No, says Peter, others may fall away. I won't. I'm going on well. I don't feel in any danger spiritually. I don't feel tempted by Satan. There's no way Satan will get past my defences. And just a few hours later, Jesus takes his disciples to the Garden of Gethsemane. And Jesus says to his disciples, stay here and keep watch. Again he warns them, remember you're in great danger. Prepare yourself to face Satan's attacks. Pray for strength and wisdom. Be alert. But what happens? Simon Peter and the rest, they fall asleep. Imagine a man dozing off in a jungle clearing while a lion is prowling around him. But that's what Simon Peter did. And Jesus returns and Jesus says to Simon, Simon, he says, are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you won't fall into temptation. But again, Peter doesn't take it seriously. Peter just stretches out once more and once more he dozes off. He's not in any danger. He doesn't see any threat. Peter didn't feel any need to watch and pray. He didn't feel the need to search himself and see what his weaknesses were that Satan could exploit. He didn't feel any need to take steps to guard himself against the particular temptations that he was liable to face. He didn't see any need to pray that God would keep him from temptation. And before that night was out, Peter's spiritual life was in ruins. He had denied his Saviour. He had brought public disgrace upon the name of Christ. He had dishonoured God. He had crawled away a wretched, broken man, ashamed, convicted, near to despair. It would take a miracle now to restore Peter and ever make him again a useful man of God. Now, if Simon Peter, that strong, bold, zealous man, full of love for Christ, a man who had seen miracles, a man who had done miracles, a man who had preached to great crowds and cast out demons, if Satan could trap Simon Peter and tear his spiritual life to pieces so completely, shouldn't we be on our guard every moment? Are we stronger than Simon Peter? Every day we ask ourselves, what are the elements in my personality that Satan could use? What habits are developing in my life that Satan could exploit? What sinful thoughts and desires is Satan trying to plant in my mind that could lead to sinful choices? What patterns of lifestyle am I taking on that Satan could use to hinder my walk with God? What relationships is Satan bringing into my life that may distract me from following Christ? Do you see, that's what it means to be self-controlled and alert. It means to be examining yourself constantly and taking guard against Satan's cunning plans. Are you doing that? Are you aware that there are habits that Satan so subtly, so gradually builds up within us that ultimately will lead to disaster? Are you aware that there are tendencies in your personality which, if they are indulged, Satan will use ultimately to make you a ruined soul? Are you aware of the fact that that little desire that Satan has planted in your mind for something which God has forbidden, that that can grow, and that that can grow, and in the end Satan will use it to bring the whole edifice of your spiritual life crumbling into nothing? Are you examining yourself? And are you praying? Are you praying that God will guard you against Satan's vast power? Are you praying that he'll keep you from Satan's cunning? Are you watching and are you praying? Now, one of the things that we say very often to people who are going through times of particular difficulty, and especially times of suffering, is this: ask yourself what Satan is trying to achieve in this situation. Ask yourself what his objective is, what he wants to do, what he's hoping to get out of it, and then make sure he doesn't get what he wants. You know, it seems a paradoxical, almost shocking thing to say to a Christian, doesn't it? That there's a sense in which you must learn to put yourself into Satan's shoes. That you must learn to think Satan's thoughts. You must learn to see things from Satan's perspective. But really, that's common sense, isn't it? You must be like the traveller in the jungle, who's always asking himself, if I were a lion, where would I be hiding at this moment? You must be saying to yourself, Satan is trying to come upon me unexpectedly. Now, how might he do it? What strategy might he use? Some of you, of course, have read C.S. Lewis's book, Screwtape Letters. And that's what that book is all about. In that book, Lewis tries to get us to see things from Satan's viewpoint, how Satan would plan our destruction and infiltrate our lives. You must ask yourself in every situation and especially in every situation of suffering, what is Satan trying to achieve here? So in the time we have left, I want to remind you of some of the ways that Satan tries to damage and destroy Christians in times of suffering. I want to remind you of some of Satan's strategies. And I've listed seven. There are many more, but these seven seem to me particularly important. I don't know if we'll get through all seven this morning. The first is simple. Satan wants us simply to abandon the faith. He wants us to turn our back on Christ. He wants us to give up. And never forget, there are those who profess to be Christians. There are those who have had some spiritual experience, who, when suffering comes, do give up. They say, well, if this is what it means to be a Christian, it's too hard for me. I can't take any more. If God is there, and I'm not even sure of that anymore, he's let me down. I was happier before I became a Christian. And they give up. And they go back to the world. And they go back to their old friends. And they go back to their old lifestyle and their old sins. And some of them, yes, they're happy back in the old life. And maybe it will only be when they hear the voice of Christ on Judgment Day. And it is only when they hear the voice that says, depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. It is only then that they will understand how much they threw away. That's the first danger. In times of suffering, Satan may tempt us simply to give up, simply to go back to the old life. Satan, you remember, used Job's wife to tempt Job. Curse God and die, she said. Give up now. Why try any longer to live a life of faithfulness? Abandon it now. Go back, she said. Second temptation is more subtle. If Satan cannot make us give up our faith, he wants us at least to compromise our standards. He tempts us to find ways out of suffering, ways that are sinful. That's the way Peter fell, isn't it? He tried to find a way to escape suffering. But what was the way? It was blaspheming and lying and denying Christ. Peter didn't intend to renounce Christ. It wasn't apostasy. He wasn't saying, I want to go back to the old life. He was simply finding in that moment a way out of suffering. But the way out of suffering was compromise. And blasphemy. And that great man of God went that way. And Peter had to live with the shame of that all his days. Peter was wonderfully forgiven. And what Peter was wonderfully restored. But do you think the scar of that ever left him? Do you think the shame of that moment could ever be put behind him? That would always be a shadow over his heart that he had compromised and that he had failed Christ at the crucial moment. That's what Satan wants. If he cannot destroy us entirely, he wants us to compromise and he wants us to drag us into sins that will leave us permanently damaged, permanently scarred. You're in an unhappy situation. And it's all very complicated. And you can see one way out of that situation, and it's lying. Satan wants so much that you should lie. Because when you tell that lie, you deny the reality of God, who is truth. And you put a barrier between yourself and God. You're working in a place which is very hard, where you're very isolated and very lonely. And what does Satan want you to do in that place, in your suffering? He wants you to seek a way out of your suffering. But the way out of your suffering is to just join in and to compromise your standards and to join in the dubious conversations and to go down and get drunk with the other men. It's a way out of suffering. And Satan tells you that, you know, this Christian walk is just too hard. And so you compromise. A woman is lonely. She's a Christian woman, but she's in an unhappy marriage. And it's been unhappy for so many years. And now she meets this man at work who's so kind and so understanding and so lovely in every way. And she tells herself, I've got a right to happiness. I've got a right to be happy. And I can only see one way out of my suffering. And now this opportunity for happiness has come into my life. This man who takes an interest in me. What does Satan want? He wants her to break her marriage vows. And he wants her to seek happiness in a pathway of disobedience. So those are the first two dangers. Satan wants us to give up. If he can't make us give up, he wants us to compromise. And then thirdly, if he can't make us give up, and if he can't lead us into open disobedience and sin, then Satan and serving Christ. He wants to make us people who pray half-heartedly when we feel like it. He wants to make us people who are present at public worship when it's not too much trouble and when we feel up to it. He wants to make us people who witness only if we really can't get out of it, or if there are enough people around us, enough fellow Christians to sort of bolster us and give us the incentive. He wants us to make us live selfish, materialistic, worldly lives, and to stop pursuing lives of service and good works. He wants us to be half-hearted Christians. And when we're suffering, He's got so many ways of pulling us in that direction. We're feeling weary. We're feeling tired. Of course we are. When you're miserable, you feel tired, don't you? When you're miserable, you feel no energy, no drive, no zip. And so Satan says to you, well, you're too tired to pray. Wasn't that what was said to Peter and the other disciples in the garden? Watch and pray. You're too tired. Have your sleep now. And then you can pray later. Satan exploits our weariness, our lack of energy, to make us those half-hearted Christians. He uses our disappointments. We've laboured away, and we have been faithful, and we have prayed, and we have witnessed, and we have been there at all the meetings, and we have tried to be energetic in service, but we've had no reward for it. Nothing's come of it. We've not seen people converted, so we're disappointed. And Satan uses that. He uses that disappointment then to lower our spiritual zeal, to pour cold water onto our aspirations. some of you have been through hard times, difficult times over the past 12 months, 2 years, 3 years. Let me ask you, have you lowered your standards? Has Satan been winning? When you were first converted, you were so zealous. And you were so determined that you were going to be an outstanding Christian. That you were going to set a model of godliness. That you were going to be full of prayer. And you loved it. But since then, you've been so weary. And since then, you've been so disappointed. And since then, there have been so many crushing burdens. Have you lost that determination, that single-mindedness, that zeal? Has Satan been winning that battle? The fourth temptation is this: that Satan seeks in times of suffering to implant within us a bitter spirit. There are believers who remain faithful believers, and they carry on working and they carry on praying. But when you speak to them, you detect always at the back of their mind a bitterness towards God. They may never put it into words, but somehow they feel that God has been unfair. They feel they have something to complain about. And simmering beneath the surface is that enmity against God, that anger against God, that bitterness towards God. Satan plants hard thoughts towards God in their mind. And instead of having a happy gratitude towards God for all his goodness, they are infected by that spirit of bitterness. And so often it overflows not only in their attitude towards God, but in their attitude towards other believers. They become bitter towards other believers who don't understand what I'm going through. And they become bitter towards believers who have it so easy, because they look at others and they decide that others aren't having it as hard as they're having it. And so they go through life with that spirit of joyless bitterness. The fifth temptation, the fifth strategy of Satan, the fifth objective, he wants to trap us into self-pity. There are Christians, again, who go through life just full of self-pity. They can't think about anything else except how hard their lot is. And it cripples them. It cripples them. They never break out from that introversion. We've been talking about all this in so many different ways going through 1 Peter. But what a temptation it is for us to be brooding on our own misfortunes and our own unhappinesses, and to be turning them over and over in our mind, and to be looking at them and almost polishing them so that they're always fresh before us. And we're going over the griefs of last year and the year before, and we're thinking about the fact it's going to be worse next year, and it's poor me. How Satan loves to see Christians reduced to self-pity. And then a sixth danger, a sixth strategy. Satan wants to harden us into cynicism. Of all the temptations we're talking about, this is perhaps the one I find it hardest to explain. But there are Christians who are faithful Christians, zealous Christians, hard-working Christians, godly Christians. They are not full of bitterness, they are not full of rage, they're not full of self-pity, but they are cynical. They accept their lot, but they do so in a cold, dull way. And they are joyless. They simply go through life accepting the fact that life is awful, accepting the fact that this is God's will, that they should have a hard time, and it always will be. and they're unable to see God's goodness. They're unable to rejoice in anything. They never say, isn't it a wonderful morning? They never say, isn't it lovely to see the sun shining? They're always expecting the worst. They've got it fixed in their mind that God is a hard God. And he's got the right to be a hard God because he's the sovereign God. But being a hard God, he's always going to make things hard for us. He's always going to thwart all our hopes. He's always going to blight all our joys. He's always going to make this our lives in this world difficult and painful. And that's the way it's going to be. What cynicism. We have a father, not a tyrant. We have a father who loves to pour happinesses into the lap of his children. We are to expect happinesses from God, and we are to recognize them when they come. The problem with that cynical spirit, as I say, is that it makes us incapable of seeing God's goodness. It makes us incapable of rejoicing over all the happy things in life. It makes us incapable of counting blessings. The final temptation, the final strategy of Satan. He wants to make us grumpy. He wants to make us people who can't get on with others. And suffering. He can use suffering for that end. It's true, isn't it, that when you're suffering, when you're hurting, it is very hard to be pleasant and warm and caring and nice to people around you. We know that's true with other people. Somebody else is rude and grumpy and difficult and curt with us, and we say, oh, well, he's going through a hard time. But somehow we never seem to suspect that we might come over as being grumpy and difficult and nasty and curt to those around us. Satan uses unhappiness to divide Christians. Christians who are unhappy should surely be being bonded together by that, because they feel compassion for one another, and they feel love and tenderness towards one another, a mutual understanding. But Satan wants to use unhappiness to make us difficult and grumpy and insensitive about other people's hurts and hypersensitive about our own. There are 7 strategies of Satan. He wants to make us give up. He wants to make us compromise our standards. He wants to make us half-hearted believers. He wants to fill us with bitterness. He wants to make us self-pitying. He wants to make us cynical and joyless. And he wants to drive wedges between us and to use our suffering for that end. And he is cunning. Oh, he has been using these strategies for thousands of years. And the extraordinary thing is that they still work. And that is why Peter says that we are to be alert, that we are to be self-disciplined, that we are to see what danger we are in, how many ways there are that Satan can cripple a Christian, and how many crippled Christians there are, how many Christians there are who live lives without joy and without peace, and who accomplish so little for the kingdom and contribute so little to a gospel church. And the reason why is because suffering came into their lives, and instead of seeing it as an opportunity to grow in grace, Instead, they allowed Satan to use it to sour them and to ruin them. Is Satan an infallible, irresistible enemy? We talked a lot about him. And it is frightening, and it can be discouraging to talk about Satan. Greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. It is not inevitable that you will fall before this mighty enemy. It is not inevitable that he will destroy you. You may be going through a time of great suffering, but it is not inevitable that it will leave you damaged and ruined. It is not inevitable that you will be left depressed and cynical and self-pitying and bitter. It is not inevitable, because you have Christ. You have the Spirit of Christ, the one who overcame every temptation. And if you are a believer, the Spirit of Jesus lives within you. And he is able to give you wisdom. And he is able to give you strength. And he's able to give you joy in affliction. Watch and pray, said Jesus. Watch and pray. Now let me ask you this last question. Do you believe that if you pray, your prayers will be ignored? If Jesus tells you to pray for strength and grace through temptation, will he give strength and grace when you are tempted? Or having told you to pray for it, will he say, I'm not going to answer that prayer? If he tells you to watch and pray, it is because he is willing to answer your prayers. And if you, in your suffering, if you maybe in your desperation, cry out to Jesus and say, Lord Jesus, I want to honour you. I want to be a faithful, godly, holy, joyful Christian. Live in me, work in me, by your power, by your wisdom, by your grace, by your Spirit. Do you think Jesus will refuse to answer? Greater is he that is in you than that evil spirit who is in the world. Greater is our Lord Jesus than all the powers of hell. May God encourage us and speak to our hearts from his holy and infallible word. Amen.